Thank you for your attention. I know there's a lot of material that we're covering, and I know that Ann Pope's name, Paul Pope's name, and myself are hoping that enough of it comes through that it piques your interest to become close companions with this incredible poem as you continue to travel on this path of Zen practice. Over the past 3 days, Ann Pope's name has introduced us to the central point of Sengsan's poem, which essentially is to see through the dualism created by our thinking mind and open ourselves up to the unity of all things. By the way, everything we're doing during this 9 retreat is going in the very same direction. Whether you're sitting and when you catch yourself switching to your discursive mind, which makes opposites among many other things, we simply come back to this mind that's before thinking. And when we do our Kongan training, these Kongans have this just wonderful ability to transport us into the mind that is before thinking, the mind that is don't know. And as we continue to do Kongan practice, hopefully we learn to not only accustom ourselves to the realm of don't know, but by sitting with these questions after we've exhausted our discursive mind, might start seeing that we can clarify questions, whether they're these formal Kongan questions or issues that arise in our lives that our thinking mind can't quite clarify. It's amazing. Over time, I hope each of you continue Kongan practice, really learn to put trust in this realm of not knowing, not only as a place to abide in a state of balance and ease, but also as a way to bring clarity to your lives. Our chronic habit of turning our direct experience into pairs of opposites, like good and bad, self and other, also has the effect of separating us from reality. These paired opposites are created in our mind, and when we confuse these ideas with reality, suffering appears. The entire basis of Buddhism and Zen come from this identification that the mind creates so much additional suffering in our lives, not only for ourselves, but others. Yet these traditions offer us a way to remedy that. Our minds are so adept at creating opposites that we hardly notice them. We become acclimated to them. So Sengsan has done us a great favor by littering his poem with over 30 pairs of opposites. Once you notice this, once you notice how frequently these pairs of opposites are laid out through the entire poem, you'll start seeing them everywhere. And hopefully, you'll begin to realize how often your thinking mind creates them and become more attuned to whether in certain cases they're helpful or not. As Ann Pope's name already mentioned, our language also reinforces this habit. It's constructed to accommodate itself to opposites thinking. The ability to compare thing A from thing B allows us to think conceptually and distinguish one thing from another. And all of this serves a really important purpose in functioning in our day-to-day lives, our ability to communicate with others, and in our work. But it also has the unintended consequences of, by nurturing mental habits that create dividing lines between what we consider valuable and what we consider dispensable. So to quote a pair of opposites, this is neither necessarily good nor bad, but the collateral damage that results from the kind of thinking that begins to believe in the opposites we create is incalculable. In our current culture, amplified by consumerism and social media, where so much emphasis is placed on curating every aspect of our life by presenting ourselves as brands, if you will, we can become obsessed with endlessly acquire and purging things to better reflect our self-image and the lifestyle we like to see ourselves inhabiting. When we look more deeply, we see that this habitual thinking is thoughtlessly applied to other people, to classes of people, to animals, to plants and nature, and we can see how destructive it becomes, not only in our relationships with ourselves and others. Take one of the expensive seats. Where was I? But the suffering that it causes just radiates out when we start really deciding what's important, what's not, what can be discarded, what's worthy. As I was writing notes for this talk, I came upon a quote from Marcus Aurelius, who said, "Every atrocity in history begins with someone deciding who counts as human." This goes back to classical Greek times, and it was rampant before that, and it's been continuing right up to our very day, as you all know. Who counts as human? Who doesn't? This is the first step when we decide to declare war on others. Before we jump into the poem, I'd like to elaborate on a core teaching that Ann Pope's name mentioned the other day. It's sometimes known as Buddha's Two Truths. Sounds impossible, right? How can you and I both be two and not two? But as you gain insight through practice, you realize that they are simply two different ways of looking at the very same thing. In the relative day-to-day sense, you and I are two. But in the absolute sense, there's absolutely no differentiation. Everything is one. This is the insight that we can gain from practice, the insight that's passed down from generation to generation. And it doesn't just belong to Buddhism. It does not just belong to Zen. It's an insight that people have realized throughout time. This might sound mysterious, but we can experience it. We can experience right here, right now at this retreat, when we return to the state of mind before our thinking separates everything into this and that. Make no mistake, these apparent opposites are in reality indivisible in the absolute sense. Two aspects of the very same reality. The Heart Sutra probably says it yet. In fact, we were talking about this word emptiness earlier today, which I really think has been a difficult word to unpack and understand in its truest sense. But I think the Heart Sutra probably says it best. The Heart Sutra that we chant every day. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. They're two aspects of the very thing, same thing. So emptiness is not something out there that you have to find. It's already intimately connected. Intimate is even too... Intimate includes some kind of separation. It implies closeness. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. This is strictly the realization that everything we experience, you and I, everything we see, touch, taste, feel, or perceive, is going through constant change. So emptiness is, you might call it this agent of generative change that is present throughout all that we perceive. So all of this is a conceptual explanation, but as we know, Zen is primarily experiential, which is why we are spending our time practicing. Through bowing, through chanting, through sitting, through walking, meditation. All of these are ways to put ourselves in a situation where we can perceive the moment as it unfolds. And then notice when you're not doing that, when you're this overactive mind keeps beckoning you way back into conceptual thought. Okay, so let's pick up the poem where Ann Pope's name left us. Right off the bat, Sengsong begins with a warning. Although all dualities come from the one, do not be attached even to this one. After 3 days looking into this poem, it would be easy for us to gloss over this line. We've already encountered probably a dozen pairs of opposites, and here's another one, duality and one. But this one deserves your particular attention. The path of Zen is littered with casualties who have become stranded at this point. For those of us familiar with our tradition on Zen Master Sungsan's Zen circle, this is the point 180. This point that we spend so much time and energy trying to get to. This point that's already available to us, but we don't realize. Attachment to the one, which Sengsan is warning us not to fall victim to. When we do this, our small self, small I, must be left behind. Our root teacher, Zen Master Sung San, always said, let go of your small self and become or find your true self. But many Zen students, even longtime practitioners, misunderstand this statement. Our deep attachment to the small self causes so much suffering that it's easy for us to imagine our true self to be something floating out there in the ether, just beyond our grasp, where you will become free of all of your troubles. Be honest with yourself. Have you not had that thought creep into your mind? I think all of us have. But your true self is not a flawless version of your small self. Letting go of your small self, in Sung San's words, Zen Master Sung San's words, and finding your true self is not a case of trading in your perceived flaws and upgrading to a shiny new you. This is a really important point for us to come to terms with if we actually want to fully immerse ourselves in this incredible miracle we're in the middle of. Clinging to this idea can have a devastating impact on your practice. It might lead you to think your training is complete. I had this amazing experience. It's what I've been looking for all the time. You feel like you've reached that proverbial mountaintop. This condition is so common and has been so common throughout the entire history of Zen that it has a name. It's called living in a ghost cave, floating at this 180 point and staying there, attaching to it, attaching all of your ideas to it. Again, quoting Zen Master Sung San, and this was one of the most helpful things he ever said, one more step is necessary. If you reach that point where you either get a little glimpse of this still point, or whether you have some kind of mind-blowing experience, we need to take that all-important extra step and come right back down to our lives just as it is. The one that this poem is always pointing to cannot act in the real world. It's a quality of reality. But if we really want to ease suffering for our regular day-to-day selves, the people we love, our friends, our community, people we've never met, the planet, the animals, the air, the earth, the water, we need to come back down with our feet on the ground. We are the only agent that can bring about this ease of suffering, either for ourselves or for others. This is the key import of the Bodhisattva. Every day we say our vows. Sentient beings are one. We vow to awaken as one. Sentient beings are, I missaid that somehow. Numberless, yeah. But the point of it is the task of a bodhisattva, if we think about it, is impossible. The gift of the fact that these four vows we take, which start out essentially saying, this is impossible, I'm going to do it, is what makes it limitless. It leaves us with nothing to do but take on this task moment to moment with whatever we encounter. As bodhisattvas, we must free ourselves from attachment to emptiness so we can be free to provide ease in this day-to-day world. Very important point. In fact, I think so many of us who've practiced in the lineage of Zen Master Sung San have stuck with it for so long because of Zen Master Sung San's specific emphasis on function. How do we use the insight we get from practice to put it to use to help in this world of samsara? So if you stay in a dream world on that rarefied mountaintop, you can't even help yourself. It can be a form of escape. In the next section of Trust and Mind, Sung San, and by the way, Zen Master Sung San, our root teacher, and Sung San, which sounds pretty much the same due to our inability to make all the correct Chinese sounds or Korean sounds. You understand they're two different people, right? Yeah. One of the ways to spell the author of this poem, the third patriarch of Chan, is S-E-N-G hyphen T-S apostrophe A-N. And Zen Master Sung San, S-E-U-N-G space S-A-H-N. There's a, in the author's name, there's kind of a T-S sound at the beginning of each of them. So it's, you have to stay focused. We both have to stay focused. Anyway, the next line elaborates on what happens when we experience oneness. Or as Ann Popesnee mentioned earlier, he might be describing what happens when he experienced or experiences oneness. He says, when the mind exists undisturbed in the way, nothing in the world can offend. Can you imagine? Nothing offending. Boy, I want to be there. This reminds me of the old Taoist story from Chuangzi about a person crossing a river when his boat collides, when another boat collides with his skiff. Chuangzi says, if you see a person in the other boat, you might not take offense. You might simply, or if you see another person in the other boat, you likely would take offense and start shouting at that person. But if the boat was empty, you might not get angry at all. You'd simply separate the two crafts and continue on your way. This is a great illustration that I think we can all relate to as well, about how we infer intent quite often when there is no intent appearing at all. It's our reactive mind. So again, when the mind exists in an undisturbed way, nothing in the world can offend. If this sounds like a dusty old folktale, you might recall having a similar experience. I know you all have. Driving along a crowded freeway, for example, when another car crosses into your lane in front of you, and you immediately decide that the driver is simply, well, either incompetent or an a-hole, if I can be so bold. based on the kind of car they drive. I'd love to hear if anybody has never done that. And if I do, I will bow to you. So if they're driving an expensive late model luxury sedan, you know the type, your anger turns them into a self-important jerk who thinks they own the road. And if they drive an old beater, they're clearly incompetent and shouldn't have a license at all. Sang-san continues, and when a thing can no longer offend, it ceases to exist in the old way. Our relationship to this so-called thing is transformed when we don't take offense. When no discriminating thoughts arise, the old mind ceases to exist. Continuing this autobiographical story about a fictitious person driving southward on I-5 many years ago, and this anonymous person kept getting quote-unquote cut off by this van, and every time that person changed lanes, the van would change lanes and cut that person off again. And that person, absolutely incensed, decided to step on the gas and see who this aforementioned a-hole is. And there was this really wonderful young woman who was driving along, enjoying the day, singing along to the radio. That anger vanished in an instant, and the other person, broke out in laughter. It was a real teaching moment. When no discriminating thoughts arise, the old mind ceases to exist. It's gone. Boom. Incredible. When we're free from discriminating thoughts, he says, both mind and object are radically transformed from our usual way of thinking. This is how we ease samsara. Not in a lofty way, in an everyday way. Our mind's conditioned reactivity disappears and we simply perceive the unfolding of this moment, right here, right now. Next, he demonstrates how the relationship between subjects and objects, which is our usual way of perceiving the world, only exists as conceptual constructs through language. They only exist by their relationship to one another. Good cannot exist without bad. Right cannot exist without wrong. Coming cannot exist without going. If you take away one, the other disappears. It has no self-nature. This gets a little... I had to read this a few times, but I'm going to read it to you once. When thought objects vanish, the thinking subject vanishes. As when the mind vanishes, objects vanish. Subject and object also do not exist in nature. We make them. Things are objects because there's a subject mind, and the mind is a subject because there are objects. When he says thought objects vanish and thinking subject vanishes, he means that self and other have become one. This oneness, this absolute relationship of interbeing, appears when this conceptual mind disappears. We'll use that word. Next, he urges us to see this for ourselves. He says, understand the relativity of these two and the basic reality, the unity of emptiness. One, in this emptiness, the two are indistinguishable, and each contains in itself the whole world. If you do not discriminate between coarse and fine, you will not be tempted to prejudice and opinion. Here, Sang-san resolves the apparent paradox we talked about earlier, two and not two, or one and not one, in what he calls the unity of emptiness. I'm going to read that line again. I told you I wasn't, but in this emptiness, the two are indistinguishable. We'll break it down. So in emptiness, our experience has shifted to one of spacious awareness. This is what we try to find when we're doing sitting meditation. In this before thinking state of mind, our root senses are engaged. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind are awake, present, and functioning. And we observe thoughts appear and disappear like floating clouds. Without engaging our discriminative thinking, our direct perception is no longer separated into this and that. He continues, and each contains in itself the whole world. This is the insight of the Avatamsaka Sutra, or the Flower Garland Sutra, which Zen Master Jibong, my teacher, who was a university professor, said all the grad students who studied the Avatamsaka called it the Three Musketeers. One for all for one, or one in all in one. That's the takeaway. In the unity of emptiness, where is the line that divides self and other? How can any so-called thing be separate from the whole world? What is valuable? What is useless? These questions don't make any sense when we perceive this. Sang-san leaves us with this last thought. If you do not discriminate between coarse and fine, you will not be tempted to prejudice and opinion. Prejudice and opinion, this mind that creates this and that, this mind that accepts one thing and tosses out the other. Thank you.